Teachings from Turtle Island, Stories of Anishinaabe People. The Ojibwe people of Minnesota have a wealth of stories to tell. Stories of life, of death, of family, of ceremony, of culture, of history, both oral and written. Of migration, of treaties and broken treaties, of legend and spirits, and much more. Most of all, the story of the Anishinaabe, the Ojibwe people, is one of life and a determination to survive. This is the story of an Ojibwe spiritual healer. In the old days, there were many of these healers. But in the middle 1800s, when European Americans moved into Minnesota by the tens of thousands, everything changed for the Anishinaabe, the Ojibwe people. For nearly 40 years, Billy Blackwell has been taught the secret skills and stories that have been passed down orally for thousands of years by Ojibwe elders, themselves healers. Today, traditional Ojibwe healers are few and far between. Billy Blackwell is one of those. Billy lives in Grand Portage, Minnesota, near the Canadian border, and is well known and respected throughout northern Minnesota's Indian country. He is now in his early 60s, and among many interesting things about Billy Blackwell is the fact that he was raised as a white by a non-Indian father and an Ojibwe mother.
Being raised in a not an Indian way of life at all, in an Indian, in a white man type of world, with a little bit of Indian stuff always there on the edge, but not completely was I in it or that much at all. A lot of my cousins were Indians and who spoke the language. I used to hear it, you know, a lot, but I never learned it. And with the white man's way, which was so strong, that's the way I took. As a child, of course, it isn't so much that you take, but that you're given. And then as I got about 16, 17 years of age, things started happening to me. I started dreaming things, seeing things. I would go up to Gunflint Lake and I would spend much time with some of the elders, some who never went to school a day in their life, who dreamed greatly, who knew medicines, who knew things. A little while later, well, in the early 20s, I started doing these things. I moved on a reservation, Grand Portage. I learned how to sing when I was Indian songs through very good singers, young friends my age, then elders. I started then talking to the elders and how do you get to know something, to be able to see things and do things? You have to fast. That should be done before you have pubic hair. But I wasn't fasting till I was early 20s. I fasted at one time 8 days and 8 nights. After 4, the elders came out and said, "You've been here so long, you should come in." And I said, "No," and I went 4 more. From that day on or year on, I would go at least 4 days and nights every year. So I've gone over 60 fasting in my life. No food, no water. That's what gave me a lot of my visions, my dreams, my teachings from the spirits.
As Billy Blackwell passed from white to Anishinaabe over a period of years, he gained many names. All but one are in the traditional Ojibwe language, or spirit names.
My first name is Wabanaquid. People think it's Wabanaquid, but it's really properly pronounced Wabanaquid. Bebamagijik, Chief John Flatt of Grand Portage, took tobacco to an elder and said, "I'd like you to name Billy." This was when I was 17, 18 years old. On the Spirit Mountain of Thunder Bay, one of its three names is Animikiwaju, which is Thunder Mountain. It's not thundering, but Animiki is a thunderer. Animiki Ka means it's thundering. Nimiki is the one who does the thunder, or a thunderbird. And early in the morning, on a cloud, there were many clouds, a red cloud, a silver cloud, different clouds on that island that were known. And in his dreams, early in the morning, up on that mountain with the thunderbirds and the cloud is the name he gave me, Wabanaquid. As I almost died in 1979, shot in the head with the drinking of alcohol, Walter Caribou Sr. adopted me as a son. And I had already been on the tribal council here at Grand Portage in 1974. And in my path of life, the spirit of the East, who puts a mark on how long we will live, removed that mark, saying he will live longer, much longer than this. And the old man, Mamon Ogabo, Walter Caribou, with the dream, adopted me as a son because he had lost a son. So in the ceremonies of the Ojibwe Anishinaabe, his losing of a son, he took me in as a son. And he named me Sagwene Gabo, Sagwene Bitung, which means the brown feathers on the head of a bear, a giant bear in his dreams as a little boy. Things happened to me as a child, and not knowing why, I threw a baseball glove, missing a ball when I was 12 years old, and a bird came down and grabbed my baseball mitt and flew and dropped it on a tree. Years later, in beginning to walk the road of my culture, I went to a ceremony with the elders, and I said, where in my family, where do I have a clan? And the spirits said, you have had a clan for a long time, way back in your family on all sides is leadership. From one side of my family, the Mimasquash family, Louis Mimasquash was a chief, and blood on my mother's side, and Walter Caribou, who adopts me, who many of the people know, one of the traditional old Indians that was left. And he is from the Caribou family, one of the main chiefs of Grand Portage. And his wife also was from the Blackstone family, which is unbelievable history, of course, was also a chief. When that crane, a bittern crane, came down and grabbed my glove, Mushkusi, I was told by the elders in the ceremonies that long ago, them seeing your future, this is who came and took you in their clan. They took me in their clan, the Mushkusi, the bittern crane, which is a chief clan. A traditional or spirit name is probably one of the most important things that is given. Today, to talk about it, people are getting away from the rules of long ago. It's who can have a name. Now, right away, everybody says, anyone can have a name. That's true and not true. Now, with the elders of long ago, you have to, first of all, believe that way to be given a name. And if you're Christian, you weren't given a name unless you were very sick, which is still the rule, but it's broken today every day by many.
Billy Blackwell says a bad thing in his life, the time when he was shot, set him on the traditional path for good.
When I was 29 years old in 1979, the usage of alcohol got too strong in my life. I was on a tribal council in 1974 here in Grand Portage. In 79, in Minneapolis, I was shot in the head. And I died almost three times. Miraculously, I lived. And that changed my life again. I got out of a lot of things and I went strictly into spirituality. But it took me years to re-strengthen myself physically.
I asked Billy if his life and life ways provide a good model for Ojibwe people, and especially younger people.
Yes, I would, as I do, as I speak to groups, yes, to help guide their life to a good life. If, as a native person, Anishinaabe person, if they want to walk that road of their ways or to live their way, and there are many that do like that, but it's less and less today. It's many who want to only go so far.
His own children have been brought up in traditional ways. Billy Blackwell talks about why.
Well, as you're saying, I wasn't raised that way, and I wasn't. And I tell the truth, I wasn't. Then in my mind, 100%, I wanted to live that way. So I brought my children up that way. My children were not baptized. They fasted. Some of them fasted as young men. My wife at that time had her own spoon, bowls, cups, plates when she was on her moon. She never stepped near the kids' stuff. A man is never sexually with a woman when she, or anything, when she's on her moon. Now, is that mean to women? Well, I don't know. You could look at it a lot of ways. You could in ways from the white man. I'll tell you a story. A girl fasts when she's becomes a young lady. That calls her first period. My girlfriend I've been with for 7-8 years now did that 6 days and nights. She didn't really know why they were doing that to her. Charcoal on her, she couldn't eat all day, was kept somewhere. At night, they'd give a tiny little birch bark thing of berries. And she didn't really understand or know why. Later on, they're given visions, things to lead a long life. There was once a man dying of cancer. In a ceremony, they sent him to a certain village of a reservation in the 1970s. They got a hold of the family, and this girl went on her first moon of her life. They put up a wigwam, and they had laid him down, and they had her walk over him 4 times. His cancer was completely gone within 3 months. He drank a medicine, and with that, the cancer was completely killed through the power of that. So there's so many things. When my children, when we would take, in the wintertime, we burnt wood. And the ones who were winter babies, who were born in the winter, could not put the ashes on the snow. That's the white blanket that old man Winter sleeps on. In the spring, there's a big fight. He comes out with his storms. And a beautiful, beautiful young girl comes by. And out of respect for her, he leaves her alone for a while, but he comes back and he snows all over again her. But finally in the end, she comes back and she smiles and she wins and he has to go away. And with her beauty, her power, and she says that the world cannot go on without me. And that's when all things are starting to be born again. She is the spirit of spring. Her name is Seguin. So we teach those things. We give a feast. Spring is one of the biggest of the years because the new world starts then. The cleansing, the fasting comes. The first time somebody kills a partridge, kills a bird, catches a fish, there's feasts that they have. When one of my sons killed a partridge, his first kill, I called up my adopted father, Walter Caribou, and I said, my son killed a partridge. He has to have his first kill feast. Could you come tonight? And we can do that. He called me up 10 minutes later and he said, I thought about that. He said, and no, it's going to be dark. That isn't when you do that. He says, you come and get me tomorrow morning at 5:00. So finally, getting that out of my mind, I picked him up at 5. He talked for 2 hours. He said, don't ever give away that gun of his first kill. He said, come to my house. I want to show you something. He showed me wrapped with ribbons, one of the oldest guns. He said, this is the first thing I ever killed anything. In 1912 or whatever year it was. He said, I've never given this gun away. He said, that gun is animate. It's alive. Come and do it. There's so many things in life of the Anishinaabe. When we go to an elder's home, we were taught never to say anything. Let them talk. They are the ones who have gone over the four mountains of life. That of a baby, a child, an adolescent, an adult, and now they are nearing the snow on the last mountain of life, the white hare. And let them talk. The same with the people with all of our elders, the grandfathers and the grandmothers. And the name for old lady is Mindemuye. And people think that's a backlashing, disrespectful word. Mindemuye means old lady. It means, and I explain this to people, to Minjamandam means to hold on to something. Mindemuye, she who holds on to everything. She holds on to the family, grandma. Wasn't for grandma, the family wouldn't remain strong. She kept them together. And everybody wants to go to grandma's house. Everybody wants to see grandma. Because she holds the family together with, she has the wisdom. So in Anishinaabe, Bemadaziwin, the life of the Indian, there's just so many things that they that people go through. Is that being done a lot anymore? No. In some areas it is, where it's still strong. Again, I'm only speaking for myself. Although I could get 99% of the elders or 90% in these areas that I know will tell you the main reason that they keep away from them the best they can is Christianity. Number one reason, they don't want you. You're not going to go to heaven and they don't want your stuff. But you have many who try to share both. But us from ours is, don't let that in. And that's just from me and the elders.
Lately, there has been a resurgence of interest in the Ojibwe language. Ojibwe leaders and elders say Ojibwe culture and language are intertwined. As one goes, so goes the other. The language is now taught using what's called the double vowel system, which is a written language. It can differ from the traditional language, which was taught orally. Billy Blackwell says it differs in sentence structure, that the double vowel system is based more on English sentence structure, not on traditional Anishinaabe structure. He says that the double vowel system is spoken in a single dialect, as opposed to traditional Ojibwe language dialects. Inflection and even some words used by traditionally speaking Ojibwe in one region may have differed from words used in another. Inflection and even some words used by traditionally speaking Ojibwe in one region may differ from words used in another.
If you had been around enough with people, you know, I know they're from East Lake, from Mille Lacs, I know they're from Leech Lake, I know they're from Red Lake. And in talking with the elders back in the late 60s, early 70s, we all talk about that. And they say, for instance, in one area, they say horse. Everybody, you know, one of the ways, Bebe Shagoganshi, is because of their hoof, they're one. But Red Lake horse was Mishtadim. So some had different words for things, but you could always tell in the in the way that they talked.
In Billy Blackwell's opinion, and the opinion of other elders, the traditional spoken language carries emotion. And he says the double vowel system does not.
Honey Neshi Ayan. How are you? Oh, honey, neshi ayan. You know, they're sick or something, or their feelings. Emotions are in words. You're going up and down with emotions, or you're using them. In Mille Lacs, with some of their elders on the tape, you know, they're saying the way it's, you can hear that different than some other places, because they're saying it kind of the way it's talked by the elders and at home.
Does Billy Blackwell think interest in the new written Ojibwe language is a good thing?
Yes and no. I think that it's great. It's helping them a lot. Is it going to keep it? No, it's not. Not at all. Are they bringing the culture very much higher? No, they're not. No. They're only, as I've said, they only go as far as their society wants them. Some are. You go to some places like Mille Lacs, where it's very strong yet. A few other places, the same as Wisconsin, there's a few very good places. But the vast majority, even with the language, are only going so far. Same with powwows. Powwows are not the real tradition everybody thinks. It's great. Our culture is great, the powwows are going. No, that's only so far.
Given what Billy Blackwell believes, does he think traditional Ojibwe culture is gradually going away?
Beyond a doubt. I have elder I know saying the same. And we were told long ago what would happen, the same as years ago. Years ago, the culture was down, unbelievable. And it rose fantastically. And they said, again, it will go down again. And the number one major reason for that, beyond a doubt, to me, is Christianity. No doubt in my mind. I see it every day. The number two is things like pills and alcohol, money, all these things. You don't have this to keep the sacred drum society going, to keep the real traditional societies going. Are they getting stronger and better? No. They're done modern way. Same with the language. It's nice to see people speaking it somewhat, but it's being butchered up so terrible. Some places it's all right, and I'm glad at least they're learning it. I am. But it's not that I'm against it at all. Not that I'm against kids' powwows and things. I'm for that. But they don't go much further than that. It's nothing for a drum to go to a powwow and run to a church to a funeral and sing. Years ago, that was unheard of.
One postscript to the story of Billy Blackwell. In 1862, as the so-called Dakota Uprising began, relatives of his were among the first killed. His great-grandfather barely escaped being killed as he was dressed as a girl and hidden by Dakota people who chose not to fight. That man was Sam Zimmerman, a German immigrant and resident of New Ulm, who moved after the 1862 Dakota War to the North Shore, where he married an Ojibwe woman. Ancient Ojibwe history is lost in time. However, stories and legends passed down from one generation to the other do survive for the Anishinaabe, telling of the last migration of the people. History, including family trees of some Ojibwe people and archaeologists, confirm the migration. It began on the Atlantic coast of New England, where the Anishinaabe lived at the time, about 1,500 years ago. The Anishinaabe people went west, eventually to Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Canada. That migration lasted for hundreds of years, as long as 900 years. Billy Blackwell, in his years of being taught Anishinaabe spirituality and healing, was told the stories and legends of the last Ojibwe migration. He agreed to share some of them with us.
They are now in the east, and they're heading back to the west. Why? The same migrations of the caribou, of the animals, because the great power of nature in their mind, you can say great spirit, God, whatever, tells them to move. They then move. Who moves them is their thought and spirits. Every major stopping place, a sacred spirit is placed there to guard that area. Later on, they put huge markings. They know nature. They know things that they can burn. Do you know that they have great fires that never go out in places?
They fought. They had families. They made peace. They had politics.
They had treaties with one another. They had treaties out east. The Six Nations of the Iroquois had one of the biggest treaties, and the Ojibwe gave them a sacred lodge, the Anishinaabe, which was destroyed as the white man came in later. They had a thing that burnt forever in certain areas was their treaty grounds.
The Anishinaabe, guided by prophecy, according to legend, headed west out of New England. They stopped in many places, where they lived for 2 to 3 generations, sometimes longer.
They've stopped at Montreal first. They've stopped at all these places. They've gone to Lake Erie, through Ohio. One of the most powerful stopping places is present-day Detroit, Michigan, which is the south boundary of the Ojibwe, Anishinaabe, not called Ojibwe then. Everywhere they stop for a long time, they hold ceremonies, they're given in dreams, societies, secret societies, everything. They then have a very sacred spot where they stop for years. And Detroit had a huge, in history, wooden figure. If it's coal or I don't know what, it burnt year-round. Where is it? The white man destroyed it. Why? To defeat and conquer those people so they can own their territory. Their next main stopping point is Sault Ste. Marie. They're going to Waters Meet, where the waters meet from Lake Superior and the river. They then go to Bad River. They go to Madeline Island. They go south to Lac du Flambeau. They go south. At Sault Ste. Marie, the other bunch goes north. These are the clans. The elders at Lac La Croix told me how for years in the Thunder Bay area, the Moose Clan, the Deer Clan, and the Caribou Clan lived.
Billy Blackwell explained that the Ojibwe lived and traveled in clans.
They weren't known as a tribe. The clans traveled together. They're not supposed to marry within the same clan. Maybe they married from other clans, probably. I don't know in those days. Can a moose clan eat from a moose? Yes. Can a bear clan eat from a bear? Yes. People say, I was told they're not supposed to. I asked all the elders that years ago. They said, well, how would they live? They said, there's a part of that animal they can't touch. Their clan knows those things. The chief clans that signed the treaties earlier were the Crane clan. They marked by their pictures. The Eagle clan is a half-breed clan. That's not true. That's true later. The Eagle clan was here long before the white man. There's the Brown Eagle. There's the Bald Eagle. There's different Eagle clans. When the chief's daughter married, the Frenchman on his flag was an eagle. And the eagle came in and said, they said, he has no clan, he has no father. Comes from the father's clan here. The people cried and cried, and the eagle came into them to dreams and things and said, I will take this. When the British, the Bijou, the Lynx, comes in and says, I will take, because that is what the English had, the lion on their markings years ago. So the Lynx clan is a half-breed clan just for half-breeds. No, it was a clan way before.
So the Anishinaabe clans had migrated for hundreds of years from New England to the St. Lawrence River to Detroit and to Sault Ste. Marie. For many, they next traveled along the Lake Superior South Shore.
They then get to Madeline Island, at which time the height of evil, they say, happened. They vacated that for a while, but they lived there for hundreds of years. The reason they lived there, it was easy to stay away from other tribes they're at war with. It was harder for those tribes to attack them because they're out on an island. The huge trail from Madeline Island to present-day Shagawamikung, the bay at Ashland, there was a huge walking trail that went all of the way to the people of the Illinini, the Illini, Illinois, who were wiped out later. That was the huge walking trail. There were other ways to get to the Mississippi, to things. William Warren, in his book, his mother lived in Madeline Island and goes back a number of generations to their grandfather, who were traders, who traded goods there. The people go back hundreds of years before. That's Madeline Island. You are getting now at the sacred stopping places where spirits are placed. The harbor of Duluth. You are now going west. The people are migrating. It's a pretty tough walk to walk all the way to Leech Lake from Duluth through the swamps. That isn't how they were led in their migrations. In their secret societies, they knew of these things. If they were secret, we could tell, but they're secret, so we can't. They were guided all the way for hundreds and hundreds of years. They even talk of stopping in all these places, Lake Erie, Detroit, Sault Ste. Marie, Madeline Island. We were told and told to go to this place of lakes full of rice, of ducks, of game. They came across into a lake full of rice. They heard laughing. They looked on an island and saw a man with a net on his shirt. That's why they call it Net Lake. They said we would have kept going further, but were stopped by the white man. The guiding light takes them places. It goes to Grand Rapids, first Sandy Lake, which is heaven to the Indians. How were they able to live there? They drove the Sioux out. They're going to these places. They're going to Gull Lake. They're kicked out again, but they're also migrating before that. They're going up the Mississippi. They're being guided by the guiding light of spirits. They then hit Lake Winnebogoshish. They cut the foot off a Sioux at Cutfoot Sioux and send him back to Cass Lake, which is called White Bear Lake, and tell those Sioux we're coming. We've been guided to come there. They defeat them and kick them out. To go to battle, they get on the War Road, which War Road's named after. They go to their heaven, which is to go west and live, not all the time, but in the areas of no tribe owns, to hunt buffalo and to fight the other tribes. That's a heaven to them. They come back to their areas where they live. The migration ends because the white man won't let them go anymore. It comes from Chachabonning, Inger, through Lake Winnie. They're stopping places. It then goes to Bear Island. It goes to Sugar Point. It goes to Cass Lake. It's on Leech Lake now. Where they're guided to stop, there are signs that are made. The guiding light puts great sacred signs there. He plants a spirit in each place. When the white man hears of these things, through the government and church, he destroys it. He makes treaties. He lies on them. But way back, there were sacred, sacred stopping places where they lived for many years.
The story told by Billy Blackwell is of just one migration of the Ojibwe people, but the Anishinaabe go back much further than 1,500 years ago.
This is the last migration, but before there were many migrations. In the war bundles they carried, some people had flutes that were traded with Indians from South America. I've seen them. The elder said, yes, we talk of stories of when we were given in trades these flutes from people far to the south. Way back in time, we'd gone all the way to South America. They took 5 or 7 of the elders all the way down there from the clans and gave them presents for those flutes. Again, that's how long they have migrated. Journeys. When this world is cleaned again, if it is, and the storm's awful, it might happen again. We had a great, great history that goes back further than we even know. We're just going back to one journey because that's as far back as our oral history went to written. But the oral history goes back further. You have to go to the elders who know the stories. In the Anishinaabe even talked of when the Indians had to hide from being eaten by huge reptiles.
How long have Native peoples lived in the Americas, including the United States? Well, no one knows for sure, but conventional scientific thinking has centered on roughly 10 to 20,000 years. As Billy Blackwell said, Anishinaabe oral teachings say Native people go back much further. In 2010 and 2011, near Snowmass, Colorado, more than 4,600 animal bones, mostly mastodon bones, were dug up by the Denver Museum of Nature and Science. One of the mastodons appeared different from the others, in that it had been covered with rocks and found in a place where no other rocks were located nearby. Seeking an explanation, anthropologists theorized that it may have been a meat catch placed there by native people who would have killed the mastodon, butchered some of the animal, and buried the rest under rocks in shallow water to preserve and protect the meat. One of the mastodon bones had short parallel markings on it, which could indicate a scraping cut made by human beings. Research continues on the bones in an attempt to find other evidence of involvement by humans, and if conclusive evidence is found, it will prove that native people were here at least 45,000 years ago. You are listening to Teachings from Turtle Island, Stories of Anishinaabe People. Antoinette Visoner lives on the White Earth Reservation north of Detroit Lakes. White Earth is huge, the largest reservation in Minnesota, occupying 1,300 square miles, with more than 20,000 enrolled tribal members, more than half of whom live elsewhere. The western part is pure, rich, flat prairie land, and the eastern part is beautiful rolling hills filled with lakes and forests. However, the White Earth Band of Ojibwe actually owns less than 10% of its reservation, the rest having been bought or taken in a wide series of schemes by the federal and state governments along with white businessmen starting in the late 1800s. The population of the White Earth Reservation, as on the Leech Lake Ojibwe Reservation, is predominantly white. And in spite of all of White Earth's natural riches, the poverty rate is estimated to be around 50%, and the unemployment rate around 25%, according to recent census numbers. Antoinette Visoner was born and raised in Pine Point, in the far southeastern part of the res. She is an Ojibwe elder and now lives in the village of White Earth near tribal headquarters. And like most Ojibwe people, she is mixed blood. In Antoinette's case, part English, part French, and part Ojibwe. Antoinette's Ojibwe people, of course, go way back in American history, centuries upon centuries, but her English relatives, the Fairbanks family, were among the first white people in America.
1636, that house was built, and it is the original Fairbanks structure, and it's still standing today.
The Fairbanks house is located in Dedham, Massachusetts, a little bit southwest of Boston, and is considered to be the oldest standing timber frame structure in America. The family in 1636 consisted of the parents and six children, and like most early white families, following generations migrated west.
And there was a big, big family. And of course, all the brothers and sisters, they went to different areas, you know, and most of the boys, I think, came into Wisconsin and Michigan in that area. My great-grandfather, and I'm not sure how many generations back, he married a Native American. She didn't know English. They migrated into Minnesota, and he was the first fur trader in Minnesota. So that's where the Native American came in on that side on our family. On my dad's side, they originated from France. And then, of course, they went into Canada, and then that's where the Native American came in on my dad's side from Canada, because they married into Native Americans up there. In fact, my great-grandma, or great-great-grandma, was full-blooded Ojibwe.
But Antoinette Visoner has no doubts about who she is.
I don't consider myself a full-blood, or I don't consider myself white either, you know. I've been raised with the Native American people, so I am Native American. I'm still, at heart, a Native American. And I would want to be that the rest of my life.
Antoinette is in her late 60s. She is a hairdresser by trade, a mother, a foster mother, and she was raised in a two-room house in Pine Point with her father and her mother, two sisters, and a brother. She now lives in a nice home in the White Earth community, a little bit country and a little bit village, like lots of small towns. But in the early 1950s, she played a starring role in a brand new industry, television.
I have a twin sister, and her name is Bernie, and then another sister, Judy, and she's a year older than we are. But we were all the same size for many years, so everybody thought we were triplets. Well, I don't know where my dad came up with this idea, but he got us to singing. And then we started singing like when we were like 7 years old. Every Saturday morning, we'd go to Detroit Lakes and sing for the Breakfast Club show, and that was through WDAY in Fargo. And they would come into Detroit Lakes and have a live showing there, you know. So everybody was always talking about the Visner sisters singing on the radio. So everybody's listening to us every Saturday morning, you know. And my dad, every time a new song came out, he went and bought the record, and we had to listen to it over and over and over until we learned it. And then we traveled the powwow trails every weekend. We'd go powwows all over, and we went to Mille Lacs to a powwow, and this Sherman Hobart was at this powwow, and he's seen us, and he must have made a deal with my dad to have us advertise for them on WCCO in Minneapolis. We would go every weekend, we'd go down there and do a live show. We had 5 minutes to learn the song. 5 minutes. We were staying at the Minnesota Hotel downtown Minneapolis, and they came there with the music, and this woman played the song for us, and I still know that song to this day. And we were in our Indian outfits. You know, we had our buckskin outfits on, and we were in this birch bark canoe, and we had all this maple candy and maple syrup around us in this canoe, and then we'd say, "Hi there, it's Hobart's Buckets Boy." And then we had to sing, "You fall in love, yes, in love with Bucket Boy." and this song, you know, we sing the whole song, and yeah, it was interesting. I really enjoyed that, Of course, I don't know how much money we made. My dad took all the money, you know, but I was told at one time we were making like $15 a minute.
After each show on WCCO television ended, the Visner sisters' day was just beginning.
After we did our showing on Saturday afternoon, we'd have to go to all the grocery stores throughout the whole city, Minneapolis and St. Paul, and do the advertising there. And, of course, we had to stand there for hours, you know, and people would come in and shake our hands because they'd seen us on TV, and then they want our autograph because we had our postcards that we sold. And we sold a lot of postcards. Oh, my God. I can't believe it. How many signatures. I felt like I used to get so mad because I didn't want to sign anymore, you know. But we had to. My dad made us. So.
That's hard work.
Yeah. So standing there all day was hard work. Especially at that young age, you want to go out and play, and you know. But we were professionals, so we couldn't. You know, but I don't know. It was a good life.
Tragedy has played a big role in Antoinette Visner's life, as it does in most Ojibwe families in Minnesota. In fact, in most Native families all across the United States. She said her father ran out on his daughters and the rest of the family one Saturday after the WCCO-TV program and a long day of personal appearances. And that changed everything for the worst forever. In 2000, tragedy struck yet again for Antoinette. She told me she wanted to talk about it for this program.
I would like to talk about my brother who passed away. He died of a cocaine overdose. I had been sober for quite a few years when this happened, you know, and I almost went back to drinking, but I didn't. I came so close to it. But I did end up in emergency 3 times. For 3 years, I was in really bad shape. And the last time I ended up in emergency, they did all kinds of tests on me. I thought I was having a heart attack each time I went in. And so the doctor did all these tests on me, and they didn't find anything wrong. And he said, "Is there something going on with you? He said, "There's not absolutely nothing wrong with you." He said, you tell me what's going on? He said, I said, "Well, my brother passed away 3 years ago." And he says to me, "You must really miss him, huh?" And I started to cry, and I couldn't stop crying. And so he gave me this pill to take. But I took this pill, and it knocked me out. I woke up, I don't know if it was a day later or what, but I woke up and I said to myself, "This is going to stop, and it's going to stop today." And it did. I guess what really scared me the most was where he was at. The first dream I had was about a week after he died, and we were in my mom's house, and my brother's spirit was in there. And stuff was flying all over in the house, pitchers and pots and pans and clothes and everything. We were ducking, trying to get it, you know, so nothing would hit us. And he was struggling. And when we buried him, his son put his deer hunting knife in his pocket. And that's what he had in his hand. The thing is, when you dream, you only remember parts of it. But these dreams I had about him, I remembered every single bit of it. And we took off running, and he put a barrier around us so we couldn't move. That's when I woke up, and I knew he was trying to tell me something, that he was struggling, he was in a bad place. And I just lost it. I lost it. I could not stop crying. I was so worried about him. I had a ceremony done for myself and for him. he's in a bad place, they told me, and he needs help, you know. So they wanted me to make a spirit plate for him and put his favorite food on it and then put tobacco on it and burn it. So I did that. And then it was about a year later, I had another dream. And this dream was so real. We were in this building, and all of a sudden the sky lit up. It was my brother. He was out there floating around out there, and he was illuminated in white. And I went running to the window, and just as I went running in, he floated in. He looked at me, he turned around and looked at me, and he had this big smile on his face. He had three things in his hand, and one of them was an eagle feather. I think he's okay now. In fact, when I went to that ceremony, that Billy Blackwell, he's one of us, told me that it was going to take him at least five years to complete his journey where he needed to go. You know, it's going to take him a while. But he said it's a good thing he's got his hunting knife with him, you know, because he's going to have some struggles. But he said he'll be okay, and I know he is now. I know he's in a good place. But I still pray a lot for him.
And as I mentioned, Antoinette Visoner is an Anishinaabe elder, and she spoke of her basic philosophies of the life and times of the Ojibwe people.
Well, history itself tells how the white people took advantage of the Native Americans. They stole their land. They were the ones that introduced them to alcohol, you know. And I just feel like that's when all the trauma really started for everybody, all Native American people. You know, and some are still traumatized by it, you know, and there's a lot of oppression because of it, you know. I think people are oppressed if they choose to be. I mean, they can change their lives if they really want to. All you can do is move forward and be positive about, you know, your lifestyle. And I know there's a lot of oppression. I realize that, but people can help themselves if they really want to. You know, I mean, make a change for the better. But you know what really, really pleases me a lot is when I go to the powwows today, these little kids out there dancing. You know, and that tradition is being brought back to us. And so I'm just so thrilled when I see these little ones dancing. And it, to me, that circle is very sacred, you know. And I just feel so wonderful when I'm out there dancing. And that drum, it's the most beautiful thing that anybody could put. I could feel it in my heart. When I started dancing again, which is about 10 years ago, I started dancing again. And I tell everybody my heart is in beat with the drum again, you know, because it's just a wonderful feeling. But I don't know, as far as Native American spirituality, I have respect for it. You know, I'm not a non-believer. I believe in a great spirit and I believe in the traditional ways, but I'm not what they call Made. I've been to the lodge, I've been to sweat lodges, I've been to sun dances and all this stuff, but I'm not Made. And Made is a Madewian. That's their spiritual belief. It's not a religion, it's a spiritual belief. And I respect that. I respect the pipe carriers, I respect the lodge keepers and fire keepers. But I think a lot of this is coming back to us, to our people, you know, in a good way. It's just that the younger generation, they're lost. I once heard an elder say, we have a generation of children with no faces. And that really struck me when I heard that. I just thought, oh my God, you know, that's really scary. And it's true. A lot of these kids, they don't know nothing about spiritual beliefs or, like I said, respect or love or anything. And kids are having kids, you know. And we do have a lot of deaths, young kids dying from drug overdose, hanging himself, you know, suicide. It's getting worse. It's just really sad.
You are listening to Teachings from Turtle Island, Stories of Anishinaabe People. From the earliest times, over thousands of years, life for the Anishinaabe people centered around family and clan. Beginning in the late 1800s, both families and clans were broken up by the American government as it sought to destroy Indian culture and assimilate natives into white lifeways. The damage was immeasurable and continues to this day. For the Anishinaabe, family and clans survive, however, although the number of clans is far fewer than in the old days. Ojibwe people today keep close track of their extended families. It is of vital importance to them. A person on the Leech Lake Reservation, for instance, will know who her cousins are on the Red Lake Reservation and will know how they are related. They also keep close track of their ancestors and know as much as possible about exactly where they come from. Sometimes new information comes to light, and the new knowledge about an ancestor can be dramatic. Such was the case for Jim Jones, Jr. Jim is the Cultural Resource Director for the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, and he has the official responsibility for the reburial of Native people whose graves have been accidentally or purposefully uncovered. Jim is enrolled at Leech Lake, but has family on other reservations. Several years ago, he met Andy Favorite, the late, well-known historian of the White Earth Reservation, and Andy gave Jim some information that proved to be very personal to Jim Jones.
When he asked me who I was, and then he asked me where I was from, that's old school. That's finding out who your family is, where you're from, and as Andy's thinking about it, and as I answer him, he's thinking of my family and where they originate from. When I mentioned my grandfather was Bill Antel, he's already pinpointing my family and my history back to Sandy Lake. He said, your family goes back to the Mississippi Band, which was the band located at Big Sandy Lake, because that's where the Antels originate from on the original census records, and also on the original enrollment books from White Earth. Because he said when they were relocated from McGregor, which is Big Sandy Lake, over to White Earth, the name switched. And he said, your grandpa's name used to be spelled A-N-T-I-L. It switched when they got to White Earth to A-N-T-E-L-L. And I went to a family reunion over there. It lists the family from Big Sandy Lake, A-N-T-I-L, just like Andy said. And he told me that story 4 or 5 years ago before I even had the family reunion. For me, I've dealt with burial sites from these locations that have been Ojibwe burials. When I look at the time periods that those represent, you know, and you look at different events now, there's things I could probably relate to, especially around Sandy Lake now. And that one particular site I think of, because what sent me for a loop after the family reunion that weekend was my ma gave me the family history, the family genealogy, the family tree that was done that one of our relatives had started. And I had just gone from doing a repatriation, a reburial down there of an accidental unearthing. I think we have identified, I think there were 6 or 7 individuals that we had recovered, but there was 5 known coffins that were there that were impacted. But when we got done with that site, we had mapped 24 or 26 burials, 27 burials. And I was reading the family genealogy that was done. I almost choked on my food because I had just come from putting those people back in the ground that week. They were from Big Sandy Lake. The burials were 1870 to 1890, I think it was, based on buttons and artifacts found with the burials. And that's the time period where my relatives show up on the census records in Big Sandy Lake. I might have buried my own relatives at that cemetery.
As mentioned by Jim Jones, Big Sandy Lake is located just north of McGregor. Big Sandy flows directly into the Mississippi and has been home to many Native people over time. The Ojibwe arrived in the early 1700s during the Great Migration and, as Billy Blackwell said, fought and eventually defeated the Dakota living there, taking Big Sandy for themselves. Big Sandy Lake became an important place for the Ojibwe. Hundreds of people who belonged to numerous clans lived there, but the influences of European Americans and the government policy of manifest destiny as whites expanded rapidly to the west had horrific consequences at Big Sandy. In the 1780s, with numerous families and clans long established at Big Sandy Lake, the smallpox epidemic introduced by whites and spreading across the frontier hit Big Sandy hard. The population was all but wiped out. One report from back then said the number of occupied wigwams went from the hundreds to just seven. Entire clans were wiped out. Possibly two-thirds of those which were present at Big Sandy were eradicated. The large Big Sandy Anishinaabe village would never recover from the terrible illness. Then, 70 years later, in 1850, the Bureau of Indian Affairs forced the Ojibwe people, who would normally overwinter at LaPointe, Wisconsin, on Madeline Island, to travel to Big Sandy Lake and wait there for government supplies and their annual annuity payments. The move was aimed at weakening the resolve of the Anishinaabe. Angry, but having no choice, 3,000 Ojibwe men made the long journey. They left their families back at LaPointe to prepare for the coming winter as best they could. At Big Sandy, the men waited and waited. Arriving in October, they waited through the cold month of November. It wasn't until December that a small shipment of food and a portion of the promised annuity payment, money promised by the U.S. government in treaties in exchange for land, arrived. The food was spoiled. The cash payment was tiny. During the long wait, 150 Ojibwe men died at Big Sandy Lake of disease, starvation, and the cold. Now, sick, hungry, freezing, without adequate shelter for the winter, the Anishinaabe headed home. Nearly 230 more died before they got there. In October of 2000, the U.S. government placed a memorial sign in a rest area telling of the atrocity. The sign is on the west side of Big Sandy along Highway 65. You have been listening to Teachings from Turtle Island, Stories of Anishinaabe People. Teachings from Turtle Island is a production of Northern Community Radio and supported by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. White Earth Elder Mary Favorite consulted on and co-produced Teachings from Turtle Island. This is Brian Whittemore.